chapter, I want you to understand that the Roman Empire, back in the days immediately following Jesus' ascent into heaven and the church was forming, the Roman Empire was a pagan place. It was horrible. Christian values were little known or honored. Corruption was pervasive in business. Morality was at a historic low. Divorce was common to the point that marriage was little known. It was a dirty, a filthy place riddled with diseases and epidemics. Life expectancy was less than half of what it is in these United States today. Very few families had both parents, and few parents ever saw all of their children grow to adulthood. Modern methods of birth control were virtually unknown. Abortion was frequent. Medical procedures were primitive. I mean, germ theory hadn't even been invented yet, so no one was too interested to know about soap because it wasn't around. Yeah. It caused enormous social upheaval in the empire because there was a huge equilibrium amongst the sexes. There was many more men than there were women. And here's how it goes. The primary method of birth control back then was what you might call infanticide. Yeah, they would determine the gender of the child at birth. They would keep the male babies, and then they would take the female babies out to like the seashore or out into the forest where they'd die of exposure. Social upheaval because there were so many more men than there were women. That's important for you to remember. Epidemics swept through the cities to the point that up to half of the population of major cities would be periodically destroyed by measles, smallpox, the bubonic plague. We've all heard of that, right? The Black Death. Yeah. Crazy time to live for the church to form. Because what happened is, because of these epidemics, cities were depopulated. The policy of the government was to move tens of thousands of people from different parts of the empire, and overnight they would repopulate the city, resulting in communities where there were scores of different languages spoken, and people could barely communicate because they didn't know each other's language. The Roman Empire was unusual for an ancient empire in its tolerance of diverse religions. The Christianity came in under the umbrella of Judaism. However, there was a historic date when everything began to change. It was sounded like a first century 9/11, if you will. Yeah, because July 19th, AD 64, the city of Rome burned. You've probably heard of the fire and the Caesar up on the wall with his fiddle. Yeah. It burned furiously for 72 hours, and then the flames began to abate, and just when everyone thought it was safe, the flames began again and burned for three more days, destroying the homes of tens of thousands of people. You know, it was rumored that the soldiers of Nero had actually stopped the firefighters from putting out the fire because it was also rumored that the soldiers had set the fire. Yeah, until the political base of Nero was totally eroding in the Senate and amongst the people. Now, to get out of all this trouble Nero's in, he decides that, hey, we'll just blame the Christians for the fire. I mean, after all, there were rumors about the Christians, rumors that they were cannibals who ate the body and drank the blood of their leader, Jesus. Yeah. Rumors that they were against family values because they said love and loyalty to their leaders was to be greater than to family members. There was rumors that they were sexually promiscuous because of the way they loved each other behind closed doors. So Nero decided to take advantage of this and blame the Christians. So Christians were gathered up. Some of them were crucified. Some of them were sewn into the skins of animals and then thrown into the ring for wild animals. Perhaps the most heinous of all, according to the historian Tacitus, they would take Christians, dip them in pitch, and then set them on fire to light up Nero's garden at night. It was a horrible time. I say all that to say this. 3 years after Rome burned, Peter wrote in 1 Peter chapter 2, 9 through 12. This is what he wrote to the church. But you are a chosen people, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people belonging to God, that you may declare the praise of him who called you out of the darkness into his wonderful light. Once you were not a people, but now you are the people of God. Once you had not received mercy, but now you have received mercy. Dear friends, I urge you as aliens and strangers in the world to abstain from sinful desires which war against your soul. Live such good lives amongst the pagans that though they accuse you of doing wrong, they may see your good deeds and glorify God on the day he visits. Wow, he wrote that when everything was in upheaval. So how were the Christians to live in the midst of a pervasively sinful, corrupt society? Well, this is what they did. They decided to be holy, even as God is holy, that would be their mark that they were reaching to, that they would continue to pursue the calling of Jesus. So Christians, husbands and wife were faithful to each other. They avoided divorce. Women were treated with dignity and with respect. They didn't have abortions. They kept and loved girl babies. They go and looked for these babies along the seashore and in the forest and saved them, took them into their homes as if they were their own. And in that culture, especially with the growing numbers of these children, these female children, pagans began marrying earlier and earlier, younger and younger. And so the Christians would take the kids, the girls in, and they were not, many times they were not allowed out of the house at all for fear that they'd be taken as child brides. Some of them married as young as 11 and 12. Can you imagine? Yeah. But the church was different. You know, the church insisted that women not marry until they get to approximately 18 to 20. The church insisted that they were to be virgins on the day of their wedding. A calling to holy living. An astonishing change came within the empire because increasingly it became evident that the church had cornered the market on females. That is, they had a disproportionate supply of marriageable women. And as a result, single men in the remnant Roman Empire, by the tens of thousands, started coming to church. Surprise. What holy living does. Yeah. When the plagues hit the cities, the standard public health approach was to leave town, even if you left the disabled, the children, the elderly behind. But the Christians, often at the risk of the loss of their own life, would stay behind, and they would take care of all those who were abandoned, and they would feed them. They would love them. What their family members discovered when they came back 3 or 6 months later after the plague had subsided, it was a different world because Christians were making a difference. You know, they lived constantly in a holy manner that was astonishing as it just transforming their culture, their society. Now, when I went to school through my education, I was told at the beginning of the 4th century, the Roman Empire changed to become a majority Christian empire because of a vision that Emperor Constantine had, in which he saw the mark of the sign of the cross. Yeah, he had a vision about this. And the Latin words, in hoc signo vinces, in this sign, conquer. So they put crosses on the front of their shields even to remember that they were conquerors, to remember that they were called to be holy. Yeah. So He took the first two letters of Christos, and then that's the chi, and then the rho is the R, and he put those that X and that R on their banners, on their shields, and then went into battle, right? Constantine was victorious in that battle. And so in the year 313 AD, he declared Christianity to be the religion of the empire. Wow. In doing so, Christianity became the official religion of the state, if you will. That's what I was taught. However, after reading this scripture from Peter's pen, and reading what other historians have to say, and looking back at history now, I have a different take on all this. Rodney Stark, a professor in the University of Washington, wrote in his book, The Rise of Christianity. Takes more of a diligent review of history, of what actually happened. He established a baseline of AD 40, estimates that because 3,000 were converted on the day of Pentecost, right? But let's grant him that in AD 40, there was 1,000 Christian believers in the entire empire, okay? That would be about 17th 1,000 of 1% of the population, virtually no one. But by living consistent, godly, and holy lives, their numbers increased. You know, if your money can grow at 7% per year, in 10 years you can double it. Wouldn't that be cool if that was still true? Yeah. But what I'm talking about here is the law of compounding. The combination of the law of compounding and Christian holiness meant that Christians multiplied enormously until 160 years later, AD 200, there were 218,000 Christians in the Roman Empire. 1,000 to 218,000 in just 16 decades. Wow. Christians now represented 0.36% of the Roman Empire. But if you carry holy living and the law of compounding far out far enough, you'll discover that by the AD 350, there were 33.9 million Christians in the empire. Wow. Representing now 56.5% of the population. Constantine had a Christian majority. Absolutely. He had no other political choice but to legalize Christianity, to make it the religion of the state. So, because of the political choices he had made, he decided to be rescued by becoming a Christian. But it was not he who changed the empire to become Christians. It was holy living by the Christians in the church that changed their society, that transformed the empire. Yeah. And it was Constantine who recognized what the Spirit of God had done through the Church of Jesus Christ. How did they do it? Again, they lived holy lives as aliens and strangers in the empire. Wow. They abstained from sinful desires. They lived such good lives amongst the pagan that although they were accused of doing wrong, the pagan saw their good deeds and glorified God. That should sound familiar because it came right off of Peter's pen. But what about now? We often hear complaints, especially among American Christians, about worldliness, about ungodliness. I went to Kansas City, Missouri, a few years back. Went to a conference there, and a woman there raised her hand and asked, if the gospel and the church are supposed to be so effective, why is everything in America going bad? And what she was saying is that the gospel of Jesus Christ doesn't work. Really? That's what she was saying. And because perhaps the reason she said that is because she had heard that so often from our pulpits, from our broadcasts, from our books, from our conversations, it might have worked somewhere else, but it might work at another time. But we are repeatedly being told that the message of the gospel doesn't work anymore. We have had ample opportunity in America for the gospel to have a significant impact, and the message that we are repeatedly hearing is that things are getting far worse under the influence of the gospel than without it. But is that true? How bad are things? Not one of us needs to look far to see the effects of sin. We have corporate corruption, pornography, abortions, divorces, anemic churches, 5 million couples in America who are living together who are not married, clergy immorality. You've heard about those, right? Drugs, the effects of drug culture and more, but that isn't anything new. See, if we forget the history of the early church, we are doomed or we are blessed to continue it. Holy living. That's what we're talking about. Yeah. You know, there's tons of books talking about the immorality of the nation. But I want to ask the question this morning, what are we doing? What are Christians in America living like today? What kind of influence do Christians have in our country? What kind of lives are we living? I'm impressed by Christians all over the place who are facing unexpected tragedies and how they turn to God, people who have received bad diagnosis and they've drawn closer to God. They pray because they are, and this should sound familiar, they are a chosen people, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people belonging to God, that they may declare the praises of him who called us out of darkness and into his wonderful light. Let me wrap this up with a parable, a very powerful parable that's recorded in Matthew chapter 13. It's a fitting parable for those of us who live in the best of times and in the worst of times. Starting verse 24, Jesus told them another parable. The kingdom of heaven is like a man who sowed good seed in his field. But while everyone was sleeping, his enemy came and sowed weeds amongst the wheat and went away. When the wheat sprouted and formed heads, then the weeds appeared. And the owner's servants came to him and said, "Sir, didn't you sow good seed in your field? Where then did these weeds come from?" "An enemy did this," he replied. And the servants asked him, "Do you want us to go and pull them up, get rid of them?" "Oh no," he answered, "because while you are pulling the weeds, you may uproot the wheat with them. Let both grow together until the harvest, and at that time I will tell the harvesters, 'First collect the weeds and tie them in bundles to be burned, then gather the wheat and bring it into my barn.'" Jesus is describing what's happening in our time, in our place. Let there be no doubt, wheat and weeds are growing side by side with each other. Yeah. In this parable, he tells his followers not so much to worry about pulling up the weeds, that he'll take care of that later. What he tells his followers to do is to grow the wheat. Grow the wheat. Be productive disciples, holy living. Our purpose as a church was given to us by Jesus, to love the Lord with all your heart, your soul, your mind, and strength, to love your neighbor as yourself. He was asked, "Who is my neighbor?" And Jesus said, "Look around." And the third thing is he said, "Go, make disciples of Jesus Christ." So as Christian disciples of Jesus in the 21st century church, we must choose whether the focus of our ministry and our lives will be mostly about being a weed whacker or a wheat grower. I wonder which I will choose to be, what you will choose to be, what we as a church will choose to be. Yeah. I don't think we need to be weed whackers. I think we need to be wheat growers. As for me and my house, we will seek to grow the wheat. Amen. All right. Let's stand for our last song, shall we?